As I shot in Barra da Tijuca, that's in West Side Zone of Rio de Janeiro, and it's a neighborhood that started to be occupied like in the 60s, but at that time more by hippies, and then the late 80s, inspired by Florida, Miami, and so that became like the middle class dream. I think there's something that countries in development that used to be third world countries have in common, this middle class that want to somehow pretend they're living an American dream.
Was the Brazilian director Anita Rocha da Silveira discussing her latest project, a slasher movie that takes us inside the western neighbourhoods of Rio de Janeiro, with plenty of social commentary too. We'll talk to her soon. Also ahead, it's quite a week for fans of Superman and Batman. The original superheroes are finally hitting the big screen together, but is the result as spectacular as we might have hoped for?
I've developed, obviously, a relationship with the character, and I want to see the character further developed and evolved into the Superman we know and love from the comic books.
More from Henry Cavill and Ben Affleck a little later. We'll also ask Hugh Jackman about the challenges of playing real-life characters on the screen, and we'll open the covers of what might be the world's most beautiful movie magazine, Little White Lies.
I think we try and take the attitude that, like, cinema is being some kind of leveller. You know, all films created equal kind of thing.
That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of movies on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here with me at Midori House this week. Faye, a warm welcome as ever. We'll be taking an up-close look at some Brazilian cinema favourites a little later in the show, and I can't quite think of anyone who knows that topic better than you, Fernando. First, though, we've got two very different movies out at the moment that aim to depict their own take on what constitutes a hero. There is, of course, the new Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, which we'll look at a little later. But we also have the new film starring Hugh Jackman, titled Eddie the Eagle. Eddie, of course, refers to Michael Edwards, the famed and rather unlikely Olympian who became the first person to represent Great Britain in Olympic ski jumping. Faye, we'll chat about the concept of seeing real characters portrayed on screen soon, but first, Eddie the Eagle, it had its premiere here in London a few days ago, and we were there with the cast and crew. Let's hear now from stars Taron Egerton, who plays Eddie, and of course, Hugh Jackman.
The thing about this movie is, you know, Eddie was not the greatest ski jumper out there, but the very fact he got there without being the greatest ski jumper out there is a triumph in itself, and the movie's about a triumph of spirit and someone's dog goodness and determination and passion getting them where they need to be, and I think that's quite a cool story.
You're right, he wasn't trying to be a hero. He loved ski jumping, but he did do a lot of things that I certainly didn't do when I was younger. He had so many obstacles and he wouldn't stop no matter what anybody said or did, and he did it with this sort of happy-go-lucky, very charming way. It's very inspiring.
Taron Egerton and Hugh Jackman there. Fernando, we tend to hold depictions of real-life characters up to very different standards, don't we? Now, I dare say that there are a lot of people out there who don't really know much about the real Eddie the Eagle, or indeed his coach, who is, of course, played by Hugh Jackman here. Which, I suppose that might give them a little more freedom to make the roles their own, don't you think?
Absolutely. Well, I have to be honest, I don't know much about Eddie the Eagle, so I'm sure I'm going to be surprised. At the same time, when you know about a character a lot and then you see the film, you will end up being critical, because then it's never up to the game. So to be honest, it's almost better if you don't know someone. At least that's my case. So I'm going to go and watch Eddie the Eagle with a very open mind.
You really don't need to be a fan of comic book movies to know that today is quite an occasion for aficionados of the genre. Superman is, of course, the original superhero. When he debuted in print back in 1938, there really hadn't been anything like him before, and he quite literally changed the entire industry faster than a speeding bullet. Henry Cavill takes on the role of Superman for the second time in Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice. He made a surprise appearance alongside director Zack Snyder at this week's screening of the film here in London. So how did he feel about taking on the famed role once again?
I mean, not to be boring, but I don't mean to be boring, but it's just there's so many characters there to tell, and they're all representations of different personality traits and very colourful in their representation. And I'm looking forward to seeing these guys and girls enter the universe and interact with each other. I'm incredibly protective. I've developed, obviously, a relationship with the character, and I want to see the character further developed and evolved into the Superman we know and love from the comic books.
The thing about that workout was, which we talked about, like, that he wouldn't have gone and gotten, like, you know, exercise equipment and brought it and had it installed in the Batcave, so he had to kind of make do with, you know, more makeshift stuff. You can't get the Cybex guys to come install in the Batcave and go, no, don't look around that corner. That's just the... So he had to have kind of more primitive equipment.
Henry Cavill and his co-star Ben Affleck there, who bravely takes over the Batcave this time. So, how does the latest installment fare in the increasingly crowded comic book movieverse? Well, let's take a look. If you saw 2013's Man of Steel, you'll probably have guessed that this chapter is intended to be the spark of a whole new DC superhero universe on the big screen. And while DC's canon of characters has a longer and richer history than rival Marvel, the latter has certainly stolen the cinematic crown in recent years. Now, one might guess that director Zack Snyder's unrelenting, superpowered CGI machine is intended to steal it right back. But where the fun of a Marvel movie might rest upon the wit of, say, Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man or the Boy Scout naivety of Chris Evans as Captain America, here we have a brutish, bitter Ben Affleck as Batman and a frustrated Superman struggling with the concept of being worshipped as a god.
Who's that?
You must be new. That is Bruce Wayne.
Mr. Wayne, Clark Kent, Daily Planet.
What's your position on the Bat Vigilante in Gotham?
The concept of pitting two superheroes against each other is, well, a little bit silly. But the film at least tries to reflect some real-life political issues too. News identities like CNN's Anderson Cooper and CBS's Charlie Rose appear as themselves, and Superman is confused to find TV talking heads debating whether he's actually good for humanity.
Is it really surprising that the most powerful man in the world should be a figure of controversy?
We, as a population on this planet, have been looking for a savior.
We're talking about a being whose very existence...
They are not telling us the truth.
...challenges our own sense of priority in the universe.
Human beings have a horrible track record of following people of great power.
Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Chaos.
Signs depicting slogans like "Earth belongs to humans" give some weight to the allegory of Superman being the ultimate immigrant. His creators, of course, were young Jewish men of the 1930s whose parents had moved to Canada and the US from Europe. More conspicuous, however, is the view Batman holds of the godlike Superman, and it's by no means a stretch to draw similarities with recent political dialogue over 9/11. At one point, Bruce Wayne lurks around the Batcave, boiling himself into such a state that he launches into a paranoid tirade at his old butler, Alfred.
He has the power to wipe out the entire human race. If we believe there's even a 1% chance that he is our enemy, we have to take it as an absolute certainty.
Now, anyone somewhat familiar with the so-called 1% doctrine espoused by former US Vice President Dick Cheney will probably recognize what's being said here. After witnessing cities crumbling at the hands of what he saw as a Kryptonian war, that being Superman's battle against General Zod in 2013's Man of Steel, Bruce Wayne seems to have fallen so far to the political right, he all but abandons everything we've ever known about Batman in a bid to kill what he sees as a potential threat. Now, this is clearly a different interpretation of the Batman for a new cinematic franchise. which, while relatively new to the big screen, has certainly been floating around in the comic book universe for decades. Fans of Frank Miller's 1986 comic miniseries The Dark Knight Returns will recognise some of the themes here. But this film isn't aiming to be an experience in and of itself. A large part of its reason for existing is to set up other films and franchises. Now, a bloated story is one thing, but so many of the threads here are lopped off or resolved so suddenly, it's at best jarring or at worst, unintentionally comical. What we're left with isn't really a movie in the traditional sense, but more of a long, very long, 2.5 hours in fact, set up for other movies. Wonder Woman is shoehorned in with a similar finesse to that time Alicia Silverstone took on the challenge of Batgirl in the ill-fated 1997 blockbuster Batman and Robin. Presumably, we'll understand more about her reason for existing when the Wonder Woman movie is released in June next year. And let's not forget, Justice League is to follow in November. Did you say something about superhero fatigue? Surely not. Now, I love Christopher Reeve in the original Superman of 1978. It's long been one of my favourite movies. I've seen every episode of George Reeves in the old TV series. I've even watched the even older cinema serials of the 1940s, starring Kirk Allen, who would turn into a crude cartoon animation whenever he needed to take flight, and the terribly cheap Batman serial from around the same time too. These characters have been adapted for the big screen for over 70 years, and like them or loathe them, comic books speak to people in a unique and very powerful way. Richard Donner and Christopher Nolan showed us what can happen when you capture some of that magic on the screen. Dawn of Justice? Well, it may be the dawn of a long-running epic cinematic franchise, but this is not epic storytelling. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And if you're here in the UK, you can catch a special John Cassavetes retrospective. Last week, you would have seen the 1970 classic Husbands. And this week, we're fast-forwarding 10 years to see Jenna Rollins in the truly excellent thriller, Gloria.
I don't want to talk in front of the kids.
What's the matter, Mom?
Nothing's the matter. She just got the groceries, that's all.
Are the bags packed?
Yeah.
You got the money from the bank?
I don't want to talk money in front of
the
family. Don't ask me any more questions.
Where are we going?
Listen, Phil is very upset that we're leaving. That kid is so sensitive.
That's Gloria from 1980, starring Jenna Rollins and directed by the great John Cassavetes. And coming up in a couple of weeks, MUBI will be screening the 2013 film by Portuguese director Miguel Gomez, Redemption, in celebration of his epic new project, Arabian Nights. Readers of Little White Lies magazine will know all about that, though. It's featured beautifully on the cover of the current issue, with more artwork littered throughout, too. Further proof that this is quite clearly the most beautiful movie magazine around today. I'm joined now in the studio here at Midori House by the editor of Little White Lies, David Jenkins. David, I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but your magazine makes that quite difficult because the covers are always so interesting. Tell me about how the cover of Little White Lies magazine comes together.
Well, it's a bit of a drawn-out process, and I'd love to find out how other magazines, you know, achieve that result, just to know if what we're doing is radically different from that. I mean, maybe it isn't, but, you know, it involves myself. I mean, I'm more of a kind of editorial side of the process. I'm talking, you know, I'm sort of selecting the actual movies and trying to kind of communicate what it is we want to communicate to our creative director, what kind of statement we want to make about this film. And our creative director's name's Timber Smits. He's the one who's sort of chiefly in charge of selecting the cover and working with an artist or sometimes even doing it himself. And I mean, my job is just having lots of meetings with him and trying to make sure that we've seen that, you know, sometimes it's something as simple as, you know, have we seen the same movie? Have we kind of interpreted it in radically different ways? You know, tonally speaking, is an expression on a face of a character on the cover going to communicate something that's maybe doesn't tonally connect with the film itself. So it's kind of those kind of discussions. There's some sort of strange alchemical process, I would say, where Timber just will say, yeah, you know, he'll kind of delve into his sort of memory banks and say, well, I think these illustrators or these designers or these artists would be good to consider for this magazine. And then we'll have a discussion about maybe three or four options.
David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine, thank you very much for joining us here in the studio.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Kill Me Please is the debut feature from Rio de Janeiro residing director Anita Rocha de Silveira. Set in the city's western suburbs, Barra de Tijuca, the film is a challenged portrayal of the modern Brazilian life that escapes many of the clichés associated with the Latin American nation. It's a slasher flick focused on a group of high school teenagers, but it's also far from conventional, mixing plenty of social commentary about aspirational American-style living and the onward march of the evangelical Christianity. Ed Stocker spoke to the director about the movie, which played as part of the narrative feature section at South by Southwest.
Tell us a little bit about the neighborhood in which the film is set and this sort of almost strange reimagination of the American dream that this part of Rio de Janeiro is.
Yes, I shot in Barra da Tijuca, that's in West Side Zone of Rio de Janeiro. And it's a neighborhood that started to be occupied like in the 60s, but at that time morphed by hippies. And then the late 80s started to be built there, these big buildings, this complex of buildings look alike, and something inspired by Florida, Miami. And so that became like the medium class dream, to be in one of these big condominiums full of security cameras with fences. And that's also a neighborhood with a lot of highways and big shopping malls, and that's almost impossible to walk. And what's most funny, I have been showing this film in other countries, especially in Latin America. And for example, in Chile, in Colombia, everyone could relate. Like people from Chile say, hey, nearby Santiago, there's a neighborhood just like that. Nearby Cartagena, there is also a neighborhood just like that. I think there's something that countries in development that used to be third world countries have in common. This middle class that want to somehow pretend they're living an American dream.
I mean, the film is obviously, you know, eerie, it's strange, there are murders happening, we don't know who's doing them, there's a lot of feelings going on among the characters. Do you think that this neighborhood you chose to set it in kind of helped you maximize all those feelings, because it is this kind of strange place that's desolate in one area and kind of very opposed to a large part of the rest of the city? It's kind of cut off in a way.
No, of course, because this neighborhood, when you look at it, there's these big buildings with a lot of fences, but just beside them, there is a road, still a dirty road that can find somehow maybe a lot of animals crossing by. So it had a lot of contrast. And also, I shot in a more faraway area on the neighborhood where they're really expanding, nearby where we set the Olympic Games in Rio now. And also, what fascinates me about this neighborhood is just because it's so recently, there's nothing built there like 40 years ago. It's like a place with no history, with nothing attached to that, something which is completely new, so where anyone can build their own story and everything can happen because there's no tradition there.
One of the most interesting parts is the kind of religious aspect, the way evangelical preachers are trying to attract teenagers by kind of being these cool ministries. And tell us a little bit about how these preachers are trying to attract young people through their language and music and things like that, and how you use it in the film.
Now we live in a moment in Brazil that almost 30% of the Congress is formed by evangelicals. They are trying to pass laws that, for instance, if a woman's abort, she'll be arrested as a homicide, and trying to take off the school programs like the Big Ben, and for people be educated, saying that God make the universe. And they just now are able to took off the school programs any discussions about sexuality, what's really crazy. But in Brazil, you can find every kind of evangelical church, since the ones that women just can wear big dresses, since the one I portrayed in the film that's very inspired by a church called Snowball Church. The name is also in English in Brazil. There's a church where the priests are like teenager or young adults. They use a surfboard as altar, and they really try to bring more youth to the church, making haves and things like that. In the film, I made evangelical funk, but a lot of evangelical church use the music, also funk music, rock, electronic, to attract more youngsters to the church. And they are succeeding.
That was Monocle's New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker there, chatting to Brazilian director Anita Rocha de Silveira at South by Southwest in Texas. Now, if a slasher movie set in the darker underside of Rio wasn't quite enough to wash away all those fantasies of beautiful beaches and girls from Ipanema, how about an urban thriller that lifts the lid on the country's organized crime? Well, that's 2002's City of God.
Malandro tinha que sair saindo.
Quer morrer ou condenado?
Quem é condenado, meu irmão? Condenado vai ser você, se fuder que eu tô te mandando. Bota a mão pra cima, vambora. Mais respeito com a senhora, hein?
Vambora, meu irmão, vambora. Daqui,
vambora, porra.
Tá cheio de polícia ali na frente.
Foda-se, amigo. Vambora pra algum lugar, vambora.
Pisa
pra
nessa onde? Porra.
Pra algum lugar, meu irmão. Pisa nessa porra e vambora.
Fernando, I guess organized crime isn't really the first thing that springs to mind when we think of Rio, but it's not really synonymous with people's perceptions of Melbourne, my hometown, either. And yet there's plenty of it. Tell me about your thoughts on this side of where you come from.
Well, I have to say, City of God, I was happy and sad at the same time. Happy because it was the beginning of a new era for Brazilian cinema, in a way, because I think people start to pay attention again to Brazilian cinema at the year of 2002. I mean, it's an excellent film by Fernando Meirelles, which is actually now a Hollywood director. He's doing a lot of, English films, in a way. But at the same time, it portrays the crime in the city as a very violent film. It shows certain communities in the 60s in this place called Cidade de Deus, City of God in the title. It's a very poor area of Rio de Janeiro. But, you know, there's clever editing, incredible soundtrack. There is this kind of beautiful, languid Brazilian storyline as well. So, that you know, sad thing that people associate the city with crime, which is fair enough. It is a violent city, but it's also the beginning of a new era in Brazilian cinema. And, you know, it did very well in the box office. And so it was not only a film for the critics, in a way. And it was nominated for 4 Oscars. This never happened to Brazilian cinema before. Of course, he didn't win any of them, but that's okay. Just to be nominated, it's fine.
It's good just to be there anyway. We sort of have a similar thing where I'm from. Melbourne isn't really known by any particular thing. I mean, Rio obviously has beautiful beaches. It's a beautifully photogenic city. So we are talking about a very, very different
city. You have good coffee, apparently.
We do have very good coffee. Quite hard to translate that to a beautiful cinematic sequence, however. The city does lend itself quite well when we start to look at the sort of darker underworld. We had the film in 2010, Animal Kingdom, for which Jackie Weaver was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. Absolutely wonderful film. And yet, similarly, it does not present Melbourne in a very positive light. And yet, for many people who lived there, many people who simply know Melbourne, it was a wonderful film, and it was so fascinating to watch and sort of get an insight into how this sort of bleak existence really happens. For someone who is Brazilian, seeing this side of your country depicted on the screen, how do you feel about that part of your culture?
As I said, I still feel proud, especially when it's a good film, City of God. But I have to be honest, after City of God, most Brazilian films that were released abroad, I have to say abroad, because actually in the internal market is a different story. We have actually comedies are our main films at the box office. But apparently people don't want to see Brazilian comedies. They want to see very heavy social dramas with a touch of violence showing the favelas, which is, of course, a big part of Brazilian society. But it's not all. The shame is actually the other other film that actually had more or less the same relevance worldwide as City of God was Elite Squad, and the sequel The Enemy Within, which were actually from the current Rio de Janeiro, and it talked about the special police forces, and in my opinion it was more violent than City of God, and it was more kind of dry, gray. There was not so much clever editing or, you know, like a photography. Even the soundtrack was a bit harsher in a way. It's a good film, but it definitely not portrays well the situation about Brazil. And sometimes I wish there could be a lighter film. I mean, we're starting to do that. For example, we had The Second Mother, which we spoke at the cinema show a few days before. The Way He Looks, which is a lovely gay film with a blind boy who finds love. So it's kind of changing. But if you ask the average person, they still think, you know, they still think about the favela film, which is fine. I'm okay with that.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up, because Elite Squad, The Enemy Within, is the other film I want to have a bit of a discussion about today. This film is from 2010. Let's hear a clip first.
Eu não tinha mais alternativa. Eu tinha que bater de frente com o sistema.
Ô, doutor, tem uma blitz em frente ao seu condomínio.
Como é que é, Braddock?
Tem uma blitz em frente ao seu condomínio. Eu posso parar, doutor?
Só que no Brasil é muito difícil prender a autoridade.
Encosta aí que eu vou enquadrar esses caras.
Político, então, nem se fala.
Fernando, again, we're here in the darker side of Rio de Janeiro, and here we have a security officer who is swept up in a tense political dispute involving the government and paramilitary groups. Now, I was talking to the writer of the Swedish TV series Blue Eyes earlier this week, and he spoke about how the political reality in today's Europe is really why we're starting to see those sorts of stories popping up in films and on television as well. But it does occur to me when looking at this film that Brazil, of course, has also been going through plenty of tense political turmoil, which is really reaching fever pitch right now. What are your thoughts on how all of that is reflected in the sorts of films and television that we see coming out of your country?
Well, I mean, if I can focus a little bit, especially on Elite Squad, The Enemy Within, which is the sequel of Elite Squad, I think is a very relevant film for Brazilian society in a way. And no surprise there, that is the highest grossing film, Brazilian film ever. And it's very controversial. It's funny because the main actor, Wagner Moura, which some of you might know, he's the main actor in Narcos, the Netflix series. He's well known in Brazil as a lefty, you know, he supports the government, you know, he's very kind of pro-human rights. But in the film, he plays this kind of very kind of sad and dark police officer, which is almost like a paramilitary group in the city of Rio de Janeiro. Some critics said the film is quite right-wing. They have this kind of every robber should be killed in a way. And I think there's a huge sector of Brazilian society that supports that in a way, because it is a violent country and people sometimes get tired of it. But it almost verges on the far-right elements. So it's very interesting that such a lefty actor can play such a role. And there's been so many analyses on papers and everything talking about this film. And then the director defending himself is saying, I'm just portraying reality. I'm not being political here. It's just the way it is. You know, those police forces exist. The population supports them. So yeah, it is a good film. It's certainly not my favorite Brazilian film, but it created so much debate that I thought it was very healthy.
Well, both City of God and Elite Squad, The Enemy Within, are showing on Mubi for subscribers over in the US right now. And that's it for this week. Whether you're planning on spending the Easter weekend wandering the beaches of Rio de Janeiro or taking in the sights of the city via the screen, the movies offer such a unique form of escapism, it's hard not to feel a pinch of disappointment when it all goes wrong. For every Batman and Robin, however, there's a Batman Returns. This latest outing might be in for a rough landing, but in the words of one Mr. Alfred Pennyworth, why do we fall? So we can learn to pick ourselves up. Today's show was edited by Monocle's own dynamic duo Wei Dong Lin and Kieran Banerjee, and researched with cat-like precision by Yolene Goffin. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com, or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can always get in touch with me by sending an email to br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show, of course, returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.